Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, April 5th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everybody who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice. And if you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on the link. Download it, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and you can get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through the worksheet process. They can serve as a tutorial for you to learn how to apply this tool in your life. Some of those shows are people giving testimonials about how effectively and positively the use of these tools has changed their life for the better. And some are just clarifying shows, discussing how it is that a tool that is seemingly so simple can have such a dramatic positive impact in our lives. So we encourage people to do that soon and often. Go there, download the app, download the worksheet process, listen to the files, the audio files of past shows, and or read Dr. Michael Rice's chapter of his book, because that frequently leads to comments or questions or testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1 on your phone, and it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. And I will see it and turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. And thank you, Susan, for doing that yesterday. That provided the content for the entire show. And you can do the same if you have questions or comments. We have been working through the Way of Mastery since January 10th this year. And yesterday Susan was asking clarifying questions about that very process. The Way of Mastery as a set of tools. And I was delighted with the question and the opportunity to try and clarify that when the Way of Mastery is talking about the energy of desire, it is not talking about any specific thought pattern that I generate when I say, oh, I want this, or I crave that, or I think I need that. That those specific thought patterns are not what's being referred to in the Way of Mastery. The energy of creation, the energy of flow of life, the energy that gives us an impulse, that gives rise to this energy within us that becomes a thought or a specific focus of a target of our thought, that's what's being referred to in Lesson 4 of the Way of Mastery. This very powerful but subtle energy that most of us have either never been introduced to, or we've been trained to distrust or disbelieve or think that anybody who imagines that they hear that energy, they feel that energy, they're guided by that energy, that anybody who's doing that is somehow off the mark or crazy or wacko. And yet, oddly enough, it's the process, the stopping and asking, you know, what does life want me to do here? What would love ask me to do here? What would the flow of the creative energy direct me to do here so that I might be a blessing to myself or others? That questioning, that learning to live in that questioning state, that willingness to be open, wide open in terms of the questioning, in terms of awareness of more subtle energies, in terms of being willing to understand that I don't know anything in truth. I don't know when I was created, how or by whom or what. I don't know why I was created. I don't know what my brother or sister might need in the next moment. And this kind of obsession with knowing and the obsession with relying on the conscious logical mind for all of our work and answers is a trap. It is a well-known trap in spiritual circles, which is why most spiritual circles, trainings, wisdom schools, etc., have different approaches to trying to help us cancel our need to be right. That specific phrase is woven into the worksheet process. I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need for anyone or anything to change, including myself. And I ask to be shown what has been hidden from my mind, or what I'm turning away from within my mind. The places in me, or in the Way of Mastery, in the beginning promise, it says, where fear has made a home in my mind. And my task, you know, should I decide to accept it, is to search for those places where fear has made a home in my mind and embrace them lovingly, to accept this, the fear itself and the judgment of it as negative, to accept all of that as simply self-caused, and to understand that I do not need to listen to fear tell me yet one more time what to do to stay in fear for another day. I can recognize the fear, the pattern of thought that generates it. That's one use I can make of this intellectual mind. I can let the intellectual mind help me recognize those intellectual thought patterns that are unproductive, that continually trap me in this negative pattern of thought, and then try to convince me through that another pattern of thought that it's going to help me get out of it. And the negative thought patterns that I generate are never going to be escaped or dismantled in my mind through the use of thought. And the Way of Mastery tells me, okay, so here's what you can do. You can use your intellect to identify those errors in thought and those mistaken patterns, which it calls roadblocks. And then what do? Well, then I turn those roadblocks over to something more integrated, more wise, more far-reaching than the conscious logical mind. You can call it God, light, love, Holy Spirit, but I turn it over to something other than my conscious logical mind, and then I ask to be shown. Okay, but then what do? Then I breathe and I soften and I ask to be shown. And I resist the urge to use the intellect as a pattern of escape. Right? That's the training, the conditioning of our culture is rely on the intellect. Learn to figure it out. If at first you don't succeed by trying to figure it out, then try harder by figuring it out more. And that very monotonous pattern is never going to lead to a different result. It's always going to leave me feeling sad, scared, hurt, tired, angry, frustrated, confused, overwhelmed. It's just the way of, you know, every tool produces a result just like the tool. And what does thought do? Thought spins and goes nowhere. So how can thought do anything other than help me spin and go nowhere? It can't. And yet, each and every one of us is the product of something that's much more integrated, much more sensitive to various types of energies, including emotions and, you know, the non-physical energies and sensations. And those can offer us a different path, a different way to interact with life. How we get there, we ask to be shown. And we recognize when the conscious logical mind or the intellect is rushing in and trying to provide different kinds of solutions. And we catch it and we just gently, lovingly, playfully, with childlike innocence say, oh, there's that pattern of trying to figure it out. I know that pattern. I've been there before. I'm just going to breathe and soften and let that go. I'm going to notice the tension that gets generated in me from that and breathe and soften and let it go. And then when my mind starts to race with, okay, but then what should I do? I'm going to breathe and soften and let it go. And as the Way of Mastery has pointed out already in these first five or six lessons, maybe already into the seventh, instead of that leading to me being sedentary and just like a leaf blown on the wind, instead of it leading to inactivity, it leads to a place where I'm far more active. It leads to my being led by spirit, by something far more integrated than my conscious logical mind, insight, intuition, creativity. And as long as the body lasts, the Way of Mastery points out to us, it leads to me being far more active. And so this is another one of those paradoxical truths of our lives that my conscious logical mind throws up to me and says, wait a minute, if I don't figure out what to do, then I'm just going to sit here and breathe and soften and ask to be shown, and then what? I got to do something after that, and I've got to figure it out, and there must be a plan or a map or a template or something, or what have the other great people done? And let me take a look at what some great saint did when he or she was faced with a homeless person, or they were confronted by somebody who was persecuting them. Let me read up about what somebody else did in a similar situation so I can learn from there what I should do. And that's the intellect again jumping in and trying to take over, and that will never lead me to a better life. That will never lead me to this connection I say I want, to this joy, to this sense of fulfillment, to this living into the fullness of life that we're all designed to do. I think I remember from one of the Alan Cohen books, there are a couple of his books that I read once or twice a year. One of them is The Tao Made Easy, and the other one is The Course in Miracles Made Easy. But he tells a story in there about somebody who just kept trying to do what he thought The Course in Miracles would tell him to do in one situation or another. Well, because I'm a spiritual person, I'm supposed to never walk by a homeless person or somebody who's begging. I should always give them money or food or both. And so, here's a person who did that, and he did it, and it seemed to work out well for the homeless person, was very happy and grateful, and then a few months later, living in that belief system of I'm supposed to help everybody that asks for help, or I'm supposed to be a spiritual person, so I should give money here or stop and talk to this person or whatever, he did it again. Only this time, the person, mugged him, grabbed his wallet, found out he had money in there and mugged him and turned out miserably. And so he's talking to one of his spiritual teachers and saying, how could this happen? I was doing what a good spiritual person should do. And the teacher comes out and says, look, what we're asking you to do in this work is to be awake and aware and present in the moment. If you approach somebody on the street, you're walking down the street and somebody approaches you either way, and they're homeless and they're begging and they seem to be hungry and their clothes are all torn, and you think, oh, I'm a spiritual person, I'm supposed to help here. You are not living in the moment. You are not awake and aware. You are not reading the energies coming off of that person or the intuitive energetic response inside you. You're not tapping into the energy of creation that the Way of Mastery would call desire and asking to be shown in that moment what's yours to do here. And when you do that, it's like living your life with blinders on. You're living from the past. You're living from belief. You're living from, and the nature of belief is this is an old thought. This is dead. This is from the past. And when I live in that space from the past, if I live from the space of my thoughts about this is what should be happening and I'm right and this person's wrong, and that's like living my life with blinders on. Right? I mean, that will only always and forever direct me into more conflict and more upset and more me against them. I was giving the example yesterday when we were discussing this with Susan that I had a situation with my sister over the weekend, and if I'd stayed in my intellect was going to tell me my side of the story and how I'm right and she's wrong and how I'm being magnanimous, and I'm there to help her, and she, just because of the way I said something or the choice of my timing to say something, she's taking offense, and that's wrong. She shouldn't take offense, and she should be glad I'm there. That's all my intellect is ever going to do, is churn up more and more evidence for how I'm in the right and this person's in the wrong. And this work, the way of mastery as a set of tools and teachings, calls us to giving up the idea that we know what's right, relying on the alarm system of our negative emotional state, recognizing that we're the ones creating our own experience of life. It starts right out in the first lesson, and the second lesson echoes it and goes deeper. Everything I experience in life, I'm creating. And then the third lesson comes in and says, let's build on what we just talked about. Not only am I creating my experience of life, I'm creating my experience of everybody I interact with. And so in the situation we're talking about from Saturday, if I'm interacting with my sister, and if I see her as anything other than the presence of the creative energy expressing in form, if I see her as doing anything other than either extending loving energy or extending a cry for help and healing, and I see her as this energy of creation, completely in the flow of life, who can't do anything to hurt me and my true essence, then the only thing for me to do is extend loving energy to her. But if I go into my intellect and I do what the lesson three in the Way of Mastery says, in every moment where I generate a negative perception of somebody else, the previous moment what happened was I decided to pretend that I'm not creating my experience of life. So in the moment of interacting with my sister, and I'm feeling overwhelmed, and I'm feeling this resentment, and I'm feeling hurt by her actions, my mind is trying to tell me I'm hurt by her actions. But my higher self, this ability to observe, can wake me up to the fact that, oh, Tim, you're generating upset in you with the choices of thoughts and interpretations that you've just placed on this interaction with your sister. And if you act from that right now, it's going to be like pouring emotional gasoline on an emotional fire. It's going to blow up. Your sister, Tim, is just the presence of love expressing in form. She cannot hurt your true essence. And if she's coming at you lovingly and praising you and so glad for your presence and being there, she's just extending that energy of love in this interaction. If she's coming at you with any kind of frustration or sadness or hurt or anger, it means she's crying for help and healing. When I can interrupt that pattern within me, not the pattern of interaction between me and the other person, but the pattern within me that's generating the negative emotion, when I can wake up and use any tightness, any tension as indication from lesson three, that this is the place where Tim needs to dismantle a false perception, then I've got a tool I can use. And so far from being an intellectual exercise and discussions about who's right or who's wrong or what's the true nature of desire, what really the reason I'm presenting this work this year is this is a set of tools that fits like a hand in a glove with the reality management worksheet, with my figuring out, okay, what's my goal here? What are my thoughts doing? How am I using my thoughts to generate a negative emotional state or a false belief? How is that generating this negative image of someone outside of me? And how is my mind trying to convince me that they are causing my upset right now? And then thirdly, what is my goal? What is my mind telling me I need to make happen, or I need to have happen, or I need to get somebody else to make happen, so that I don't have to feel this upset? once I've mapped that out, once I've slowed down and looked inside and figured out what am I doing with my thought energy, how is that generating this emotion, what is that lining up for me as a goal that I think needs to happen that I'm attaching so much of my intention and attention to, then let me cancel all of that and ask to be shown. Let me move from knowing that I'm right and they're wrong into questioning what the heck's going on here. How is my mind yet again creating a perceptual experience that's generating the negativity that I say I don't want? That's the process of the Reality Management Worksheet process. That's almost exactly what it's being called for in the way of mastery in Lesson 3, prepped by Lesson 1 and 2, where it says, look, you're creating your experience of life, Lesson 3, and you're creating your experience of everyone you're interacting with, Lesson 4, now that you're busy catching your negative perceptions and all of the ways that you're generating false perceptions about the world and the people around you, let's give you something else to focus on. Let's give you a tool that can help enlighten you by waking you up to what life wants to share through you, how you might be this open conduit for the creative energy in more and more situations throughout your life. How do you get to that? You have to wake up to what that energy is and how it's moving through you and how it might want to express through you, how it might be part of your guidance system. One part of my guidance system is the early warning detection for any negative physical, mental, or emotional experience. Right? So that's that. I talk frequently in the support groups and on the internet show here about a two-prong approach. The one-prong approach is, one of the prongs is, I'm going to remember that if there's any negativity coming up in my experience of life, I'm going to take 100% responsibility for it and choose to use a tool to find the origins of it in my own thought or my trauma energies from the past and release my attachment to it, dismantle it, change my allegiance away from that and shift that allegiance over to something else. What would the other thing be that I'm going to shift my allegiance over to? The awareness of the presence of love, the awareness of the creative energy moving through me in every moment. Two-prong approach. And this lesson 4 in the way of mastery is that second approach, that second prong. Learning to tune into the energy of life, energy of love, energy of creation moving through me, living me, giving me existence. It's only, always, and forever going to be loving and inclusive and expansive. It's the creative energy. All it does is create. It extends, it expands, it creates, it blesses, and I can be a conduit for that. I can be a conduit for that continues to work at being open and clear, that continues to remove the roadblocks from my family history and the bloodline and my personal history of trauma in this life, and that one of those phrases that I talked about yesterday that I became aware of on Saturday, one of those negative thought patterns that jumped up for me was, oh, I'm never good enough. No matter what I do, it's not going to be enough. Oh, that's a pattern I downloaded somewhere along the line, probably in interactions with my paternal grandmother, probably with some teachers, probably with some friends, maybe with the Catholic Church that I was raised in and trying to be a good little holy boy and never have a negative thought and all that kind of stuff. But the fact remains, here I am, a fully grown adult, interacting with my fully grown adult sister, and as it didn't work out well, as I had negativity come up in me and she had negativity and her come up in her, as soon as I got away from that, I started breathing and asking to be shown, and I had this thought, oh, here it is, I'm never good enough. No matter what I do, it's not going to work. Okay, there's some more worksheets. There's some more energy in me that I can identify and release and breathe through. There's more in-the-moment evidence that this clashing interaction between me and my sister wasn't caused by her. I bring that, no matter what I do, it's never good enough, into every interaction I enter. It may not come up to the surface. It may not make conscious awareness. And yet, any time I choose an interpretation for the life events unfolding around me or the people I'm interacting with, and I throw that label on it, oh, here's evidence that I'm not good enough. All of those negative emotional states from decades ago that I've been carrying in my system, they flood up. That's what was having me, you know, choke up with tears on Saturday. That's what would have me constantly feeding the negative thoughts about what she's doing isn't right and what I'm doing is right. And this work would have me take a breath, do almost exactly what the reality management worksheet would tell me to do. Take a breath, turn the focus inside, identify the thoughts I'm using to create this negative emotion, just like the Way of Mastery says. Wake up to the fact that I'm the one creating this experience. In the first two lessons, third lesson, wake up to the fact that if I'm having a negative picture in my mind about my sister, I'm the one creating it. It's based on false perception. And the act of forgiveness is me dismantling those negative perceptions of her. It has nothing to do with letting her off the hook for anything. It has to do with turning inside myself and figuring out, how am I just created an image of this being of brilliance and light, this extension of the creative energy and form, and how have I created an image in my head that shows me, here's somebody who's attacking me. Here's somebody that's dangerous. Here's somebody that doesn't appreciate me. When I turn the focus inside and I get clear about that, then I ask, okay, so what is my mind telling me needs to happen? Well, she needs to, and you have to, and okay, those are my goals. I'm going to cancel those, and I'm going to go back into that, the Way of Mastery would call divine ignorance. I'm going to ask to be shown. I'm going to say, I don't know what any of this is or is for. And I don't know how to be a blessing in this moment. Here's my conscious logical mind. Part of me might even be retaining, you know, the training to be a clinical psychologist and a doctorate in psychology and, you know, 48 years of experience doing therapy. None of that is telling me in that moment, how can I help? How can I extend love to my sister? How can I see her as a blessing happening in form? None of that is doing that. All of that stuff will show me, oh, she's wounded, and oh, you know, she's triggered, and oh, you know, she should have respected that you came and gave your time. It's going to give me all these rationalizations. It might even serve up a couple of different diagnoses I can throw on the situation for myself or her. I can either beat myself up and talk about how horrible I am, or I can use all that education and training to label her as having a problem. None of that will take me to the place that I say I want to go, which is I want to be in touch with my true nature as love. I want to be able to extend that true nature to everyone and everything. So if my intellect can't help me get there, even with a doctorate, what hope is there? The hope is I put the intellect aside and I go into my open heart space and I ask to be shown. I recognize from this space of divine ignorance that there is something that can step in here and extend loving energy through me. And that eventually, even though I don't know how, this is all going to work out. That if I don't buy into the labels and the conflict and the drama and trauma, it's all going to fade away out of my perception. I'm the one that's creating that perception in the first place. So if I ask to be shown how to see my brother and sister the way the Creator would see them, if I ask to be shown the shimmering radiance of this creative life force underneath everything, including myself, I can step into a world of experience that goes beyond words. That's why we're presenting this work. We are much less interested in philosophical discussions about what is the meaning of the word, this word or that word. We're very interested in how can I be different in the next moment? How can I be fully awake and aware and in appreciation of the energy of love, of life, of creation, expressing in, through, as, and around me in each moment, even in those moments where I have chosen an interpretation of the flow of life that resonates old traumatic energies I'm carrying in my system. And, of course, one of the things that we, one of the words we use for that pattern of energy that we experience right before that kind of thing happens is fear. Here's this word, fear. And in the seventh lesson, the last time we were reading it, last Friday, I think, I stopped right before it gets to the story of the shadow of fear. If anybody's following along in the book, it's near the top of page 87 in The Way of Mastery. And the text reads, okay, so if you are this quality of life and love and the extension of love in form, if you are here to abide in that love and simply be the presence of love because you know there's absolutely no value in being anything else, and that in truth you've never succeeded in any attempt that you've made to be anything other than the presence of love, if all of that is true, then whatever could possibly arise to obstruct that truth from your awareness? The text reads, the truth that is true always. And so here's the story. There's an ancient planet, an ancient forest on your planet, a forest so high and in a rugged mountain valley, so rugged that no one has ever been there. This is completely unknown to the minds of humanity, and life goes on in that forest. Deep within the heart of that forest this morning, a little tiny blade of grass seemed to be tossed by an unseen wind. As it was tossed for just a fragment of a moment, so subtle and soft was this wind, that as the sunlight played against this blade of grass, it cast the smallest of conceivable shadows on a stone that was just a little bit away from the blade of grass. Now, in truth, no one noticed, and the shadow had no effect. The rock didn't even notice. No one on the planet noticed. Not one in any of the heavens noticed, except for me, because I needed something to build a story around. That tiny shadow, cast by a little blade of grass, momentarily wiggling in a wind in some remote forest, has virtually no effect on the turning of the planets, on the creation of new suns, and certainly not one trace of effect on how deeply the Creator loves you. That little shadow is what you have given power to. That little shadow is the only thing that could ever obstruct the truth that is true always. That little shadow is what blocks from you simply the awareness of your presence as love in the moment. That little shadow is what you have given power to. And because of your creative forces of perception, you create your own perception. It seems to be able to obstruct the truth, the capital T truth within you, from being lived. It doesn't obstruct the truth from being lived in you. It just seems to be obstructed. For the moment, you gave that little tiny shadow power. And in that moment, fear was born. Fear is always a contraction away from love. And fear makes you smaller than the blade of grass that momentarily seems to cast a shadow and therefore obstructs your recognition of the warmth of the sun that bathes you always. You cannot be separated from the force of creation that gave rise to you, and yet you can create the dream of separation. The text goes on and says, please know this. When you resist healing, when you struggle to speak your truth, you may rest assured that something has occurred just prior to that. What is it? It's your decision to believe that the shadow is all-powerful, and that if you heal, if you grow, if you change, if you let the Christ live in you, then that little blade of grass and the tiny little shadow it creates for a very temporary moment, that will come and crush you and punish you. If you can truly take this story into your being and recognize the utter laughability of such a belief, you will never fear fear again. You will never again allow fear to master you and direct the course of your life. Now, how does this relate to our real life? Something was going on Saturday. Something about my experience of life and all of the things that are going on with my mother and my practice and my hopes for the busy week ahead and this coming week where there's family coming into town to celebrate my mother's birthday. Something was going on in my thought process that had me believing I'm not going to be able to get all of this done. I'm not going to be able to please everyone. I'm not going to be able to handle the emotions of my mother's decline. I'm not going to be able to remain the great and powerful Dr. Hayes and be flawless. Something in me, this little blade of grass, this fear, this shadow, something from my conditioning had me believing, uh-oh, you're not going to be enough. You're not going to be able to do everything that needs to be done within the period of time it needs to be done. You're not going to be able to satisfy everyone. All kinds of permutations of that thought, I now know, had been bubbling up in me, maybe for weeks, but at least for a week, leading into the interaction I talked about on Saturday. That's the only thing that can obstruct my perception of, my experience of, being the presence of love and being able to extend that loving energy to everyone and everything in every moment. That's why this is a set of tools. If I can wake up to the idea that every one of those negative emotions in me has its root at some level in the original dream of separation, in the original fear that gets generated in that dream of separation, in the original set of thoughts about, I'm not going to get back to unity with the great mind. I'm not going to be able to be enough. I'm not going to be able to get it right. If I can learn the absolute laughability of any of those thoughts, you cannot be separated from the flow of life. You cannot be separated from your Creator. You cannot fail in being the extension of love and form. It says, on the bottom of page 86, the previous page, it says, in truth, you have never succeeded at being anything but the presence of love. So when you fear that you're not going to be enough or you're not going to be able to extend love, that's as silly as thinking that little shadow cast by that little tiny blade of grass is going to come and crush you and punish you if you let the Christ live through you. Now, it's worded very carefully, and it says, if you wake up to the laughability of such a belief, you'll never again fear fear. It doesn't say you'll never have fear. It says you won't believe that the fear has any power to crush you and punish you. You'll recognize it as a passing energy and thought. You'll breathe and soften and let it go. You'll cancel any goals that flood into the mind as that energy tends to get intensified. And as the text goes on, it says, you will learn what it means to trust what is birthed in your heart. And you will arise and you will go forth without fear, with no story at all. You will accomplish whatever creativity wishes to express through you. This is that creativity in this word here is the same as the energy of desire, the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you. You will not let the story or the fearful thoughts that they generate obstruct the flow of creative energy. You will extend love in every moment, consciously. And the whole while, you will know that of yourself, you do nothing, but the Creator through you can do anything. So if you really want to move forward in your life, this part of the book, the next text says, let's slow down and take a look at what forms of that shadow, of that little blade of grass, have you been giving power to, and have you allowed to possess your soul? Saturday, I got introduced to another aspect of that little blade of grass and that little shadow buried in me, these negative emotional energies around, uh-oh, I'm failing, uh-oh, I'm not enough, uh-oh, I'm never good enough, I'll never be perfect, and if I'm not perfect, I'm a complete and utter failure, or whatever those are. This part of the text in Lesson 7 calls us to slow down and get conscious of what are these things that we're generating fear about, not being good enough for this person or that person. And the text reads, there are many forms of the shadow, are there not? There are peers and parents and siblings to please. There are governments to bow down before. There are mates and children, and they must come first. There are bills to pay. There are desires to keep in check. There are activities and statements and behaviors that are done by others that require at least 7 or 8 hours a day for you to analyze and judge them to death. And then you think, my, this world is exhausting. Well, but somebody has to do it, and you go right back into it. You go back into judgment. You go back into thoughts of fear. You go back into I'm right and they're wrong, or they're right and I'm wrong. Putting myself down is the same as putting someone else down. It's judgment, and judgment is the opposite of love. It's the opposite of forgiveness. It's the opposite of dismantling false negative perceptions. The text goes on and says, and you thought love makes the world go round. But please, trust me, love does not spin and go nowhere. Love, the energy of creation, created you. Love birthed within you as an individual, at least within this dance of time and space. Love birthed within you the power to choose, the power to feel, the power to channel light and love, the power to know that something exists within and as you. That is what love has done. Ask yourself, has fear ever created anything remotely like that? So what do you want? Do you want creation, the flow of life expressing through you, wide open, or mimicry? Do you want peace, or do you want the ability to simply drug yourself with triviality? Imagine this. All power under heaven and earth flowing through you with every breath so that your consciousness, not what you do as the maker or doer, but that which the divine is flowing through you in each moment. And you get to marvel at the creativity of love. That very same love, that very same energy that moves the sun and the moon and the stars. Now, sitting back, watching and delighting in that flow of life is a delightful pastime. Judging it, generating fear about it, generating a perception that it should go in this way or that way, it should show up like this or that. You remember in a previous lesson it talked about how you cannot make desire conform to what you think it should be. You can't make love, life, you can't make the flow of creation bend to your will. It is just what it is. Love is just love. Creation is just creation. And when we move into that realization, that's when we step to a whole different level and we recognize that nothing that flows out in the expansion of the creative energy that's around us, none of it is unacceptable. We will not pull ourselves out of the flow by judging it as bad or wrong. We will be in the moment trusting that we are a part of this unfolding. And if we're here witnessing it, chances are pretty good there's something for us to do in this moment to extend the creative energy, to bless all of creation, to bless this moment and ourselves. And we cannot be doing that when we go into contraction, when we go into fear, when we go into judgment. When we allow, when we trust, when we embrace, we enjoy that pastime of observing and participating actively in the flow of life. And it says here, now that is a delightful pastime. The next section says, now you've called the body your body, as if you have some right to possess it. You didn't create it. You don't even know how it works. You don't know how to use it. So give the body to your creator. The creator knows how to use it. You do not. When your life is given to being only the presence of love for no other reason than you want it to be, you will know because you will be in that moment the truth that sets all things free. Here's another way for you to think about that. Quote, the whole of creation is waiting to move through me, and I want to be aware of it. I want to experience my lived consciousness. I want that experience to be blissfully absorbed in observing the flow of love through me. Close quotes. And if there are any cobwebs in the way of that, you will sweep them out of the way. By the way, they will come up for us to see. I got some of those on Saturday interacting with my sister. Flooded with tension, flooded with tears and sadness, flooded with irritation. These are old cobwebs, energies that I had in me attached to this thought, whatever I do is not enough. I'm never going to get it all done. I'm never going to be good enough. And I wasn't aware of it until I was in the interaction with my sister, but that had been bubbling up. Lots to do over the weekend, very little time left before the family party is supposed to happen next weekend, big full week of work this week, oh my gosh, how am I going to get it all done? And then one more demand on my time comes in, and I'm not even watching it consciously. But here it comes. I'm primed. I'm looking for an opportunity to say, look, see, you screwed that up. Look, you're not good enough here. Look, this person's upset with you. Look, it's the same old thing. It's never enough. These are the old cobwebs coming up. And the text goes on to say, if there are any of those negative thoughts, trauma energies, false beliefs about yourself in the way, when you choose to let the whole of creation move through you and you want to be aware of it, you want your experience and your lived consciousness to be blissfully absorbed in the observing that flow of love through you, every cobweb, every false belief, every trauma energy is going to come up, not as a punishment, but so you can observe it playfully with childlike innocence and let the truth of life and love sweep it away. The text goes on to say, when you are in that quality of being, heaven and earth will move to become your servant, and not until then. After all, when you send a conflicted message and nobody shows up for the dance, so now you know what the shadow is. Perhaps you enjoy dancing with it. But here's the big question. Are you going to lead or are you going to let the shadow lead? We have to keep asking ourselves, okay, especially when we're triggered. Okay. You know, Guy Finley says, we become master seminar attendees. We've all, you know, we've eaten carrot quiche and we've been smacked on the head with peacock feathers and we've, you know, kissed people's sandals and we're, you know, we've worn the duct tape over our mouths and we've done all of this stuff. He says, but yet we have a heart attack when we're in the middle of our daily life and something arises that triggers us and we can't figure out who or what we're supposed to be in that moment to make everything better. Don't figure it out. Catch yourself trying to figure it out. Take a breath, soften, go inside and ask to be shown. Lather, rinse, and repeat. Take a breath, soften, go inside and ask to be shown. Refuse to act on what your intellect will tell you. Trust that there is a bliss, there is a joyfulness, there is a way to live in this life consciously aware that you've never succeeded at being anything other than the presence of love expressing in form. And recognize the pain, the fear, the sadness, the hurt, the judgment, the grief, the rage as a false creation of your intellect and that it can be used as the warning alarm system to wake you up to the fact that in this present moment, your thoughts are off the mark. In this present moment, you're holding on to a goal that isn't getting met, and it's resonating upset you've carried with you into this situation. And you can take a breath and soften and ask to be shown the truth of your life and the truth of life expressing around you, and things will change for the better. So that's our show for today. Thank you for being here. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you, too. Have a lovely show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is Tuesday, April the 5th, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And while we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in, This coming Saturday is the second Saturday of the month, so we will be doing the Mind Shifters Still Point Breathing. And so if you're participating in that, we'll see you Saturday. Remember, we changed the time to 11 o'clock because Hawaii did not change its time, and so that allows come in at her regular time at 5 in the morning instead of 4. So it'll be at 11 o'clock, and that's this coming Saturday. If you haven't been part of the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing, it has really been awesome. I mean, even though it's been a small group, we meet every Saturday, and then we meet again the following Tuesday in order to process anything that has come up. And we'd love to have you join us. So the information is on our website. You can click and go to events or schedule and find all the information about the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. And if you're interested in doing that, if you've got our phone numbers, send us a text or call us, or you can drop me a line at jeanie@whyagain.org. That's J-E-A-N-I-E at W-H-Y-A-G-A-I-N.org. And let us know you want to be part of it. And so all the details are on the website there, and you can find those. And if you have any questions, let us know. And welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Honored that you're here once again as we move this conversation forward and understand more deeply this absolutely monumental teaching that gives us in our modern world an updated look or a rare look. I was looking for a word to describe it. A rare look at what really happens in the brain when we're doing perception and how powerful it can be to know how to collapse perception that's based in pain and process through the energies that need to be removed from the mind. And to have that tool of removal is just awesome. And yesterday we finished the show off with a conversation with Susan. So, Jeanie, I'm wondering if Susan is with us so we can continue that conversation.
She is, and I'm going to turn on her microphone.
Awesome.
Welcome, Susan.
Hey. Hi.
Hey there.
Boy, this is a rich couple of hours. I'm telling you, you just head for the couch and shut your eyes and go to heaven for a while. Boy, oh boy. Okay.
Let's do it.
Thank you. Well, I do have questions.
Well, that's a good thing because when you have questions, we get to play with answers.
Great. I have a little announcement, though. My daughter is one of four people who have been our finalists to become the Bishop of Connecticut. And
wow.
This is in the Episcopal tradition, and there are four absolutely wonderful candidates. It's going to be hard to pick, and I've been on the other end of seeing actresses in New York come in or actors come in and audition, and they're all fantastic, and they all would be good. So it comes down to what fits for them the best. So my daughter is very much aware that this is way, way out of her hands now. But she is going through letting her own cathedral parish know that she's in the running there. And, of course, there are all kinds of triggers and reactions there. So she's handling a lot just in the way of telling them she loves them and would love to be with them. And she's getting married. And her fiancé lives in Connecticut. He's a doctor up there. He would move to Jacksonville, where her cathedral is, if she doesn't get the position. And she's great because she doesn't even know what would be best. She's really waiting for the universe to decide for her what's best.
Give her the signal, eh?
But we're very waiting for the signal. And she says she'll be relieved if she gets it, and she'll be relieved if she doesn't, which seems like pretty much because it's going to be a big challenge. Anyway.
Well, that sounds awesome, and we'll join you in sending love in her direction so she has clarity. And the thought comes, it might be interesting to introduce her to the purpose worksheet and invite her to through the – if, you know, it sounds like, gee, I'm not sure which direction I should go, and more clarity on her purpose might have her say, well, this is where I'm going, and I'm going to forget that one, whichever direction it goes. It might be helpful for her in making that determination.
So, but she's, I guess what she's doing is stepping away because she can see how useful she would be up there and how much she would love it and how much of
right.
a challenge it would be. But she also has a great attraction to staying where she is because she's doing a lot of work with inner city homelessness, rehousing, refugees coming in. She's
right.
been, she's got a good brain for making the church building accessible to the community, not just a place for people of one
Sunday morning, right?
The Sunday morning crowd. It's very different down there. They're so opened up. So she sees purpose there and purpose in the other place. So
right.
You're saying something a little different, and I'm not sure I understood you.
Well, here's the direction. Here's my thinking on it. As you say, she's really good at working with people on a one-to-one basis, and I would think that being the bishop means more of an administrative position, certainly working with people, but a different angle. And in doing the purpose exercise, she might find that her strength, her being is more attuned. And when you look at the purpose exercise, looking at the things I enjoy doing, the things that I'm good at, and my vision of the world, if my vision aligns with really being that local parish acolyte that serves people, if her purpose shows her that's what really fits, that may help her to be more comfortable saying, no, I'm not going to even go to the bishop. I'm not even going to apply because it's really not aligned with my purpose. Or on the other hand, it might be, well, I have the strengths and I have the ability and the administration and the things that I'll be doing there. So it might just help her to get clarity on which function is she really made for. It sounds like she could do either function quite well, but probably crispness on her purpose from that higher level would give her more insight. Just a thought, anyway.
It's a good thought. She would be one-on-one with the priest. She would be the priest to the priests, and she
right.
would love that. So that's a big part of it. So
cool.
She would help them with their struggle. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like either place she's going to expand her ability to serve, and congratulations on her getting married. That's I hadn't heard before that was in the wind.
Well, this was one of those things where there was a young man in her high school class who adored her, and she liked him. But they went their separate ways. He married. He became a doctor. He's got three kids, and 3 years ago he got a divorce. And when he saw that she was divorcing, he got in touch with her and said, can we talk? And she said, I'd love it. And well, long story short, they're getting married.
Sweet. Well, that's awesome.
And he is such a wonderful man. You know, you're always afraid you might repeat what you did before to try to get it right.
Right.
But she has married a man who is loving, and he just adores her, and he is very well loved by his coworkers and everything. It's not a repeat of the other. Yeah, she feels as though
awesome.
She got it right this time. Yeah, thanks.
Well, I hold the space that it's also an uplift for the boys and their process and their struggle.
Well, you know, Michael, what's weird is he had a very abusive father. So he has done his work in an amazing way. And he is such a loving father to these boys. And he can talk to them about what it's like to have a father who isn't well mentally, who loves them, but not well. I mean, there's no blaming or anything. He's just supporting
right.
them and talking to them. And it's gorgeous.
Well, fabulous. It sounds like, you know, once again, she's been doing her work. And I'm sure that it's also a reflection of the work that you and Tim have been doing to hold the space and to support her. So, sweet.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Well, and now we get to two of the boys. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just an upgrade in the whole genetic history moving forward.
I sure hope so. It looks that way. Yeah.
Sweet.
So we were talking about OCD yesterday, and I would like to add to the mix because I've been doing some research on ADHD, too.
Yes.
Because one of the other grand boys, the one who had the breakdown and who has had this psychotic episode and who's been diagnosed with bipolar 1 now and put on a medication for that that is supposed to be helpful, and they're in the, very much in the medical model. So, but he often says that he's ADHD. He has said it for a couple of years now, and I've been listening to podcasts on that. And one thing they say is they're often very bright. They know what needs doing, but they can't do it. They need very,
right.
very specific directives from outside saying, and with consequences if those things aren't done, almost like a very little kid. And I wondered if you could talk about that, whatever you know about that.
Well, two perspectives that I would, from the perspective of this work, two thoughts I would have. The bipolar, I mean, if you think about it, when you recognize that perception is a construct of the mind, and constructs of the mind come from goals, bipolar would mean that we have a reality over here in one corner and a reality over here in another corner, and each is driven by conflicting goals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen people with bipolar who start to clean up their conflicting goals, become more unified with themselves, you know, let go of that split, and start to, you know, work with the forgiveness process and canceling goals, and get back to a place where all of a sudden there's not, I mean, we all have our conflicts. Gee, you know, somebody says, do I want to go to dinner tomorrow? Well, yeah, I'd like to go, but, you know, I'd like to stay home. Well, I'd like to go. I mean, in a sense, that's a minor case of it. We've all got a certain amount of that. But in the extreme where there's a lot of emotion attached to it and has led people to a lot of trauma, it's the same principle as conflicting goals. So the first thing I'd be teaching is canceling goals, especially the goals that relate to what people would consider to be the negative side of the bipolar condition. Does that fit? Does that make sense from what you've been studying and learning with what you've been following through with?
I'm not able to match them only because it seems as if it's almost like the two personalities. There's a flip.
Yes.
But the doctor was saying in the case of my middle grand boy who has this diagnosis, is that he'll go for months being fine. And then if he's really bipolar, he will flip for maybe a month more in a different, as if he's a different person. So
right.
I don't know how it's, I'm not matching up the goal thing with that.
So if you were to quiz him, if you were to sit down and talk to him about a time period where he was what the world classifies as doing just fine, he was in the good side of the situation. If you were to just sit down and just talk about, well, what's going on in your life? You know, you had that 3-month period and you were this and that, you know, things were going well. What kind of things were you aiming for? What were you shooting for in your life? And start identifying what his goals were. And then have an interview with him, talked to him about when things were on the other side of the coin and what was going on. What were you thinking about? What was going on? And you will find there is a totally, completely conflicting set of goals in each of those situations. And that leads to the mind doing conflicting or opposite constructs. And you know, the purpose of a construct of the mind is to produce a behavior to achieve a goal. When you change the goals, the perceptual constructs change, and the whole direction of a life can change. The guidance that the mind gives for doing behavior, if I'm heading in one direction, I'm going to look like one person. If I start heading off in another direction with different goals and different behaviors, which are a result of goals, then I'm going in a totally different direction. And yes, oftentimes I think it's a reflection of multiple personality disorder, which is usually the result of some form of abuse in early childhood. Mm. In either case, collapsing the pained perception that people say this is the unacceptable side of the bipolar, or these are the unacceptable effects, is to start looking at, well, what's driving that construct? What's driving one to be inclined toward this behavior or that?
Mm.
And if you start getting rid of what drives one toward that behavior is going to tend to disappear, resulting in, oh, we've got this behavior and a consistency in this behavior. And whenever it tends to go off the rails, start looking at, okay, so, you know, start looking at what was the trigger? What happened when all of a sudden he went from, you know, this, you know, everything's fine, everything acceptable, he's rocking along with his life, he's doing school, he's doing, you know, his music or his projects. What happened? And you'll probably find there was some sort of a trigger that activated some of those unachieved goals. Remember, once you put a goal into the mind, there are only two ways to get rid of it. One, it either needs to be achieved. Two, it needs to be canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's never achieved, you know, if it's the goal, you know, what gets triggered one day as a result of a phone call with the abusive dad is, oh, my God, I have to make dad happy. I have to do what he wants me to do. And, you know, I was going along with what my purpose, you know, my grandmother introduced me to the purpose worksheet. I realized what my purpose is, and I'm doing it rock and roll. I'm just, you know, having a blast doing it. And then one day I got a phone call from my dad, and he said, what the hell are you doing that crap for? Yeah, that'll never get you anywhere. That'll never make you any money. Why don't you do what I've already told you to do? And that trigger sets another set of, a whole other set of goals in motion. One of those sets of goals has to go in order to get rid of the bipolar would be my offering from the point of view of first century Aramaic forgiveness.
Well, the picture you paint of a happy rocking along kid wasn't ever there. He was always struggling. And he had two goals, to get through school and become an actor in New York. The other goal was to feel okay, to feel well.
Right.
And he started taking pot and then LSD to feel better. And he was microdosing with mushrooms and doing all kinds of experimental stuff to help himself get better. And at
right.
one point, he stopped being able to sleep, and he went through a month-long period of now what they say was mania. He didn't sleep for a month, and then he
right.
had a psychotic break. So
break.
I'm,
yeah.
I'm not clear about the different goals, and he's not in touch with his father. I know I'm being very literal. You've given a general
right.
useful overview of how to do it, and I'm talking about a specific kid and not knowing how to. But I am going to spend
right.
10 days with him. My daughter's going up to Connecticut to do all the walkabouts and things you do if you're a candidate for admission. I'm going to be grandmother
right.
in charge in Florida. Yay! So I'll get to talk
Sweet.
To him, and I hope do the worksheets with him as part of the deal with him, because with ADHD, they say give a goal, And you do something to meet the goal. And one of the things is, okay, in order to do this, we're going to do a worksheet and we're going to do this. And I'm going to be rather tough, I think, and just say, you have to do this before I'm going to give you an allowance or whatever it is. And see how that goes.
Right.
Anyway, I'm all over the place, Michael, I know.
Do sorry things that support him. You know, and the ADHD, my offering, my best understanding of it, not that it's the only understanding, but it's my best, is that when one is brought up in what is perceived to be with a violent power person, in what's perceived to be a dangerous environment, you know, the kid who's feeling safe, connected, centered, you know, everything's good in their lives, and they're sitting one day, you know, 3 years of age and, you know, coloring away, just having fun, and along comes the violent parent and, you know, from the right side comes over and whacks them in the head and starts raging at them. Here's the kid who's in safety and blindsided, and once that happens, safety internally is not going to be easy to find. And so the ADHD, again, my take, is that the child is now going to continuously be scanning the environment in order to remain safe. Mm-hmm. And until safety's there and the internal perception that it's not safe, I mean, how do you stay focused? I mean, in order to really excel at something, the tendency is I'm going to be totally focused in this. I immerse myself in it. You know, you look at the whole Montessori education system, and they say, for instance, you know, when the three-year-old's ready to learn math, I mean, everybody says, well, by the age of five, the child should learn this amount of math. A three-year-old, if they're ready to learn math in the Montessori environment, the teacher is simply there to provide the environment. Watch the, oh, this child's ready to learn math? Put them in a math environment, and within days, they'll learn what otherwise would take years for somebody to learn, because they can be totally focused and centered in what they're, they call it a sensitive period, what they're in a sensitive period for. Well, if you're not, if your environment isn't safe, and you enter a sensitive period for anything, you can't be focused on it, because you're always, you know, okay, I look here because, boy, I'm ready to learn math, and 2 + 2, well, wait a minute, let me make sure there's nobody coming over my right shoulder. 2 + 2, mm-hmm. Oh, I heard a voice, I heard a noise, let me look over. And there's not the focus to absorb that topic, to absorb that that particular subject, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so, again, two things. One would be the safety process, forgiveness of the violations that have occurred that keep warning internally. We need to be looking for it. And two, and the higher cortical functions only happen when we're in a parasympathetic mode. If we're in sympathetic dominant mode, fear, flight, fright, or freeze, that leaves the higher cortical functions, which come from the function of the vagus nerve, shut down. Doesn't work. You don't have those higher functions. And if you're always looking around to be in safety, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to keep that part of the brain, the higher possibilities, operational. And so forgiveness of the realities, of the experiences of that created the feeling and the experience of unsafety, and then stimulating the parasympathetic and the vagus nerve so that higher brain works, and bingo, hey, I focused on this and I stayed with this for hours. But if they're not safe, they can't stay with anything for hours, be my offering.
Well,
and so it'd
sense.
Be, from the point of view of this work, it'd be a combination of forgiveness around whoever the power person was, whatever the dynamics were, And, you know, and that might have been with Dad, that might have been Big Brother, that might have been, you know, the observing of what happened to Big Brother. It might be, you know, any number of things that that child as an individual needs to remove in terms of constructs in his mind from, you know, those past experiences. And then getting to safety, you know, just being safe is huge. And oftentimes the child, I think, who's in ADHD because they're protecting themselves isn't performing. And the fact that they're not performing means that even people who aren't the power person are going to tend to be frustrated if they haven't resolved their own frustration, if they don't understand what's going on in their own environment. They may, you know, try to force the child. There may be an upset. There may be a lot going on for them. And now another power person dynamic is established because the child isn't performing out of higher cortical functions, which, gee, I saw you do that 2 weeks ago. What happened to you? You were such a good student until 2 weeks ago. What happened? Oh, that was when I got beat up on the street corner by a gang of kids and, you know, sexually assaulted. Oh, that's when your marks dropped. That's when your higher cortical functions disappeared. That's when they diagnosed you with ADHD. You couldn't pay attention. So from the perspective of that work, that'd be how I'd offer it, see it. And you know, and of course, then the answer would be all of the above, every tool. And in particular, a space of someone who's the caretaker in the space or the main, you know, adult in the space for a younger person is there to support safety and forgiveness. But that part of the brain just doesn't turn on until there's safety.
Yeah. I think that's very true for Jacob. He's afraid of making any decision because it's probably going to be wrong. So
now, you might want to look. There might be just, you know, I mean, this might be silly to even think about, but there might even be a genetic component to that. There might be somebody else in the family that tends
it
to
does that,
do that
yes.
sort of, do we know anybody
All
else
right,
in the family
Michael.
That's ever done that?
Point taken.
So you know what needs to be worked through. It's, I mean, I'd yep. offer that adaptation is something that's inherited, and as we become conscious of it in ourselves, we'll tend to see it around us and start to open the space for healing. And to, you know, there's where the mind shifter tool comes in. And, you know, here's how you get to look at the hidden parts of your mind that are running you from an unconscious place, grandson. And together we can clean this up.
Yeah. That'll be a good opportunity.
Safety. The biggest thing probably for you, if you're going to spend 10 days with him, which is awesome, will be that every goal you hold for him to perform in any way, shape, or form that you'd like him to, you need to let go of so that
Absolutely.
You're in a state of peace,
understand
whatever
that.
He does. And that state of peace means he's
I
safe. That you're there with approval no matter. And not just, you know, that you don't verbalize disapproval. You literally clean up any disapproval in yourself because it reflects in your energy field. It reflects in your face. It reflects in your words, voice tone, everything.
Right.
It's all part of the healing process.
I really get that. I do get that. Yeah. And the youngest boy went out to Colorado with his father to look at colleges. And his father was so threatening to him at one point that he sat in their car way deep into the night, not daring to go back to the hotel. Got so cold, he went back to hotel. Dad wouldn't speak to him. Came home and said to his mother, "Mom, I was mad at you for leaving Dad. Now I know you had to leave, and you protected us from him all those years, and I had a good childhood. This was the one his dad favored. But now that
right.
he's the only one who has any contact with his dad is working
yeah.
his miracles on this boy.
Yeah.
So he said to his mother, my dad, I can't live with my dad anymore, but he tells me he'll kill himself if I leave. And his mother said, you have to leave. And that's his responsibility.
Yeah.
So he has moved out. He's moved in with his mother. And the other boys don't have anything to do with the father anymore. Once in a while, they may have a short discussion on the phone, but the texts that went from that father to that youngest boy were so awful, Catherine took the phone from him and said, I don't want you reading these. This isn't good. They may change his phone
yeah.
number, or I don't know what they'll do, but it's just the sickest thing, Michael. Beyond
well, there's comprehension. There's everything we've been talking about in a nutshell right there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how unsafe do you have to be that, I mean, you can't even go into a hotel room because you're going to be looking around, looking for safety, so you stay in the car and freeze. It's like,
yeah.
bless his heart.
Yeah.
And bless his father's heart, because the kind of pain he's under, you know, we've got some idea of what his power person did to him by watching his behavior with his own children. It's a tough place to live. So I'm holding space for him as well.
Thing. It's we don't know where that came from. Well, I know there must be something, but Catherine knew the parents. And he has two older sisters. There's no evidence that there was such a power person in his life. They don't understand why he's this way or where it came from. And I know it's probably somewhere down the line, but.
Yeah, and remember that a power person isn't always a parent. It usually is,
mm-hmm.
but not always. I mean, the scenario that I described or that I used as an example a few minutes ago, gee, you know, I was off at school and I was attacked and sexually assaulted actually came from a client that I worked with who had some power person dynamics in his life, but his really serious mental disorders didn't happen until there was an assault by a group of other teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that ended up actually leading to some really serious consequences for this young man.
Mm. Well, we don't know what that was, not to say there wasn't something, but the father was a minister, very gentle and yeah, okay.
And there can be a lot of schizophrenia and you know, I have no idea what kind of religious background he had, but there can be lots of schizophrenia in God is love and the beginning of wisdom is fear of God. I mean, if that isn't
mm-hmm,
schizophrenia,
yeah.
I don't know what is. If that isn't
yeah.
bipolar, I don't know what is. If that doesn't
mm-hmm.
mean I have to be watching all the time to stay safe, I don't know what is. And, of course, then it comes, you know, we hear the raging preacher. I mean, I can remember sitting in a Baptist church here in Bristol, and the preacher's just up there raging about sin and evil, and, I mean, the whole nine yards. And there's this little guy who's probably 12 years old sitting two seats in front of us. And, I mean, I just watch this kid shrink and, you know, almost watching his being evaporate from his body as he's listening to this raging preacher.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, and fortunately, because of the tools Yeshua developed, we don't have to figure out where it came from. You know, remember trying to figure it out to the booby prize. If I apply
yeah.
forgiveness, I'll work through whatever it is. I don't have to figure it out. You know, there's a line in the Course in Miracles that says, you must return your mind to the point at which the original offense happened. Does that mean I have to sit around for the next 25 years on the couch and find the deep, dark, dirty thing that happened to me? No, that will never happen. That will never be
mm-hmm.
figured out. But if I walk forward, if I have a comprehension of the tools, and I recognize myself as love, though I don't always feel and experience myself that way, if I recognize it's who I am, then I commit to walking forward in my life as the active presence of love. And when something triggers that which is less than love in me, I apply forgiveness. I cancel the goal that's driving the pained perception at the moment, and the pained perception drops in on itself, on its root. That's where the mind is returned, at least energetically, if not cognitively. And you know, over the years of working with people, and you've heard it many times on the radio show, somebody cancels a goal, and all of a sudden it's like, pop, there's a memory. That's what the Course is talking about. With forgiveness, you get to return. It's not about, now I have to make this, you know, forced journey to remember the terrible thing that happened. No. If I collapse pain perception every time it comes up, I will oftentimes cognitively remember the event that's at the root of it. And if I don't cognitively remember, I can energetically process through it. That's where I continue to breathe. That's where I continue to hold love present, cultivate the presence of love in me, and keep moving through those layers. And they will dissolve and fall apart. They'll disappear.
Thank goodness we have access to them that way.
I'll tell you, one of the things I've been talking a lot with Aria Rain about is how, like, we've been doing, the other day we did a painting project, and it was just like, isn't it really cool that somebody, you know, invented a jar that we could put paint in, and somebody made a paintbrush, and we could just get, I mean, isn't it wonderful, all the people who've done all those things that we can do what we're doing now. So we're kind of building brain cells for appreciation and such. And to me, the most, you know, profound level of appreciation is that this man 2,000 years ago put it together and said, here's how it works. I mean, it's because most everybody, pardon me, who thinks they have to figure it out is, or no, pardon me, not most everybody. Everybody who thinks they have to figure it out is doomed to failure, because when you start taking all the complexities of all these energy patterns and everything goes on, someone who reads that line in the Course, you've got to return your mind to the point at which the original offense happened. And people start, now I have to figure it out. It's like, well, actually you read another, and I'm not sure where it is exactly, but another place in the Course says, your part, you've got a part in it. How do you do that? You cancel the goal. Let go all the things you think you want, your trifling treasure put away. Leave a clean and open space within your mind for the active presence of love to be brought forward in the presence of what surfaces from the canceling of the goal. And when the two meet, the underlying energy starts to dissipate and disappear. I mean, I can recognize very clearly. I mean, it took me 30 to just say the last four sentences that I said. It took me 35 years full-time working with the teachings of Yeshua to be able to say that. I can't imagine it without the teachings of Yeshua to have explained it, and then building the brain cells to understand what he explained. I can't imagine ever figuring it out on my own. Having that's like, thank God I had that foundation. Thank God we have that foundation. It's monumental. And there's nowhere else in the culture. Say again?
That you stayed with it. You bore into it. It's like, what's the word? There's a sentence in the story about Jesus on the road to Emmaus. He had already left the body, and he appeared to his disciples, and they said that he opened to us the scriptures. That's what you're doing.
Yeah. That's it. And then, you know, when he gives us that key that you've got to have rachma, that's what opens it. And, you know, There's actually a book that I started working in, and you've heard me talk about it before. You may remember it now or may not, but it was originally called The 11 Most Important Words Ever Spoken, and it was where they ask him, what's most important in the law, the way things work? He says you must have rachma, and you have it for two objects of attention, the creator and neighbor, which pretty much covers anybody you can think about. And then by so doing, you will maintain yourself. So there's a whole package of how you have a human life. And then he says, for upon this hangs the law and all the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, here's how you open the scriptures up. You have rachma when you think of creator, when you think of neighbor. And by so doing, you awaken self. And now you'll understand what the scriptures had to say directly. Because you'll be out of your mind. You know, it's like the bottom line of all healing is you got to be out of your mind. The secrets are not hidden in the mind. They're hidden by the mind. And that's why the forgiveness process is so important at collapsing the mind. Where there's any form of pain, trauma in any way, shape, or form, collapse the mind. Collapse it. And when you're out of your mind, that is what opens the key to the scriptures. Because now you're reading not data based in your mind, stimulated by what you read on a piece of paper. That now is out of the way. You're going directly from your being to the teachings a man offered, and here it is. And, you know, I mean, there are, you know, what was that old saying, you know, there are a billion stories or whatever in the naked city. How many variations on a theme of pain and trauma are there? As many as we can imagine. How many problems are there? There's only one. We made something more important than staying connected to the truth of who we are as love.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one solution. Mm-hmm. Let loose, let go, cancel, process out, forgive that which you've made more important than staying connected to your source. And go back and reestablish that connection. So reminding those two young men who they are, and yep, there are problems in their minds. And they're all resolvable.
And they do
and they
have
are.
A family that loves them and is there for them. And Catherine keeps reminding them that, look, we have one person who's not well in the family. But the rest of us are with you and always have been. Take note.
Your voice has just about disappeared.
Sorry. Can you hear me now?
You're back a little better. Sound like you were moving away from the microphone, maybe?
Well, they're in my new hearing aids, and man, are they weird, but I'm getting used to them. It has a microphone right in the ears, and I don't have to have my phone with me. I could be walking around anywhere and be listening to you and talking to you.
Oh, cool.
I'm not, I think I probably touched one of them in a funny way. Sorry, I'm getting used to what I can do.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing, Michael. I went out walking this morning, and the birds, my world had become quite silent, and I thought it was climate change, and a lot of it is. I went out this morning, and it was so loud, it almost hurt. These birds were
singing. With your new hearing aids.
They were singing their
guts. Oh, that's awesome.
Well, you remind me of my mother. Yeah.
My mother had cataracts. And didn't realize what she was missing. And when they took her cataracts off, she cried at just the vibrancy, the color of the world, this, you know, just the sensory
amazing.
Input that she'd been
it's
missing.
Amazing.
That's awesome.
Yep. I know.
Well, in working with those two young men, you'll probably be more able to tune into their voice tones that will communicate things to you that you'd perhaps been missing. That'll probably enhance your ability to be with them.
Maybe. Yeah, I'm going to have them in all the time. The only problem is I can't play the piano with them in. sounds like a honky-tonk piano. It's just the piano's out of tune. And I don't know whether that's a remediable thing or not, but there's some interaction between the live. It doesn't bother with singing, but with a piano, with those strings, I guess it's the tuning fork thing. There's something resonating that's very disturbing, so I have to take them out.
Yeah, the piano's probably in a frequency range that hearing aids are probably attuned to the human voice. Piano is a different
mm-hmm.
frequency range, and so probably doesn't reproduce the piano so well.
Right, probably.
But
anyway,
that's awesome.
Thanks a lot for this.
All that other sound, all of the other ranges open. That's awesome.
Yeah, Tim and I are getting used to each other. He says, "I can't hear you," and I said, "Because I'm not yelling anymore. Because I can hear myself speak." I said, you've got to jack up your hearing aids.
Ah, well, that's cool. Well, that will create
probably a
much more centered, peaceful place within you, too.
Well,
awesome.
Maybe. I don't know. who knows? Yeah.
Well, I would think that the ease, the stress of having to strain to try to keep up with sound, and then the stress
mm-hmm.
of straining your voice to be heard in your
mm-hmm.
own ears, I would think that relieving those two sources of stress would probably, you know, kind of download your stress level significantly throughout your whole experience.
Yeah, well, I did have hearing aids before, and I would wear them when we went out. But with the pandemic, we've been in so much. We haven't been wearing them, and we're happy. We've been yelling at each other very happily, and in a friendly way. I'm not even aware of yelling at each other. But now I'm not yelling at him anymore. And he says, "You're not yelling." And I said, "No." And so,
would you please yell at me?
Fancy. Right. Yeah, it's funny. But, yeah, the pandemic coincided with deafness, and we never quite knew how deaf we were until we started going out again.
Well, it'll be fun to keep up with how that changes things around you. I would think it would change everything.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, Michael, well, I've had a lot of air time, and so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I think you've covered a lot of territory that opens inquiry and understanding for everybody that's listening. So thank you for your questioning mind and the willingness to share those questions with us, because that's what really makes the show work. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And we'll be holding the space. And I've got a thought. I'm going to have to do some searching for a link or two to send to you as well for a couple of videos. Cool. All right, well, you have a blessed day, and tell that young man, Tim, we tend the same in his direction, and give him a hug for us.
Thanks. Well.
All right. Okay, blessings.
I think you
can. All right, Miss Jeannie, any thoughts for you in that whole conversation, sweetheart?
No, but I have a message from somebody from the app, and it says, I'm at the part of the worksheet on my body where I'm asking myself to give up or let go of the goal. My goal is that I want to have a body to be slim, attractive, and healthy. When I consider giving up that goal, fear comes up where I'm afraid that if I don't have that goal, I will truly let myself go and indulge myself in bad food and gain even more weight and bad health if I'm not trying to control my body with that goal. Any advice that you can give me around the experience of fear around letting go of that goal?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So remember our definition of denial. And denial is the act of thinking or speaking that something outside of me is the cause of something that's moving inside of me. And so what I hear you doing is thinking that your fear is about what happens with your body. And I'd offer that that's a projection of your fear. And when you recognize that your fear isn't about your body or what it's going to do or, you know, its size or its shape or whatever it is, its health, I recognize that I have fear, and I have fear, that's all. I just have fear. and I want to be about forgiving my fear. I want to be freed of fear. When I work on that more directly, I'm going to tend to dissolve that fear more quickly. And once you recognize that you have a goal attached to a certain outcome, and there's pain around that outcome, you cancel the goal, not because there's something wrong with the goal, not because you don't want the goal to be achieved, but you cancel the goal because when you do, you get to go into that part of your mind that holds that pain and you get to process it. So what you've shared with us is that you've linked the file in your mind on your body image, what you perceive about your body as being true, its weight and what have you, that there's fear in that file. And so as long as there's fear in that file, and you may do this, you know, when they said to Yeshua, how many times do we have to forgive as to our brother? Is 7 times enough? In Aramaic, his answer was 77 times 70 times. So you may cancel that goal many, many times. And each time you cancel it, it can be perfectly appropriate because it's something you still want. I still want a trim, healthy body. So once I cancel the goal to have a trim, healthy body, because I recognize that in the file on my mind of having a trim, healthy body, there's fear and I want to process through it. That's why I'm canceling the goal. It's a perfectly wonderful goal. And once you complete that worksheet, go back and reestablish the goal. And if you reestablish the goal to have a trim, healthy body, and then you go, oh, well, I feel like eating, you know, a piece of fruit instead of having that chocolate cake that I bought last week. Oh, actually, you know, the thought of that chocolate cake is repulsive. I'm going to throw it out, and I'm going to go have myself a piece of pineapple. Or, you know, when you work through whatever the pain is in that file, so to speak, on your mind, then go back and reestablish the goal because it's a perfectly healthy, wonderful, appropriate goal. So whenever you forgive, whenever you cancel a goal, you're not canceling it because there's anything wrong with the goal. You're canceling it because when you load that goal in your mind, it recruits into activity something based in fear or pain of some sort. So you're going to cancel that goal as often as you need to until you've processed through whatever the fear or the pain is related to that goal. Then load it in your mind, and you're going to go out and create it. You just produce the result. So hopefully that makes sense. So it's about processing through what the goal brings up in you. It's not the goal itself that's the problem. It's a perfectly, you know, wonderful, appropriate goal to have a trim, healthy body. If I load it in my mind and I go into pain, I want to cancel that goal to process through the pain. And then go back and hold the vision of a trim, healthy body. You're right on track. So that would be my input there. Any thoughts for you on that, Jeannie?
No, that explained it very well. The only other thing is, you know, people talk about wanting to lose weight. Think of when you lose anything, what do? You go about trying to find it. So instead of saying, I want to lose weight, say, I want to release the weight. And it's just a slight shift, but I think it's an important one. And usually excess weight is a protection.
So back to safety. And that might mean that I cancel my need to be safe. That might be an aspect of what you do to work through an issue like weight. If I cancel my need to be safe and let myself process what's underneath that goal for safety. And that may tie right into the reason why I try to build a wall around me with weight in order to protect. And when I remove the interfering energy, when I remove the energy I'm in denial about, then I'll automatically just be inclined to do what it takes to produce that result. So I hope that serves, and thank you for sending in the question. And it looks like we've got about 5 minutes left. So, dear heart, do you have any other hands up in the phone queue or anything else happening in the chat room or in the questions the app?
There are no other questions or hands. The only other thing is maybe explain where that question came from when I said we got a question from the app, for those who maybe don't know.
Okay. Well, two thoughts I have to complete the last few minutes that we don't have a hand up. One is that this Saturday, if you want to participate, we're going to be doing a Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop Saturday and Tuesday evening. And so at 11 o'clock Eastern Time, we'll be starting with that. And if anybody wants to participate, participation includes two videos on the Mind Shifter and Still Point Breathing process. And so if you're interested in registering for that workshop, we've got it set up to run in a year-long program, so you can register for a year, or you can register for a three-month segment, or you can register for just 1 month, just one session, which we're going to do on Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We do two sessions related each month. One is on Saturday and the other is on Tuesday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. So if you're interested in joining us for Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing, you will get session 8 of the ever-expanding Mind Shifter. We've now got 8 sections. And so if you choose to participate at this point, you'd get that whole set of Mind Shifters. And if you have my number or Jeannie's, just give us a call or text us. And or you can drop Jeannie an email at jeannie@whyagain.org. So it's jeannie@whyagain.org. And then generally you want to participate, give your name, phone number, and such, and I'll touch in with you, and we'll get you set up to join us for Saturday and Tuesday. And then, as Jeannie was saying, with the app, you know, the only actual forgiveness app that exists in the world is one that Jeannie created. And if you go to your app store, you just type in the words Heartland, HEARTLAND, one word, Aramaic, ARAMAIC, forgiveness, and you'll be looking at the world's only forgiveness app, whether you're on an Android or an iPhone, that will allow you to download that app. And the latest update that Jeannie did of the app, if you have it and you haven't updated it yet, you might want to catch the update. She just did that a few weeks ago. Includes on each page of the app a button that you can click and send us a question right direct from the app. So if you're as this person was on step 3 or 5 or 7 or whatever it is, you just click that and ask your question. It hits send and it automatically comes to Jeannie. She'll share it as she did on the radio show. And then she'll communicate back with you to let you know when and where we answered the question so you can access the answer. So that's another one, just one more of the features that that Jeannie's built into the Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness app. And it's one of many features that have been added since the app was first begun. It's really becoming much, much more functional. There's access to the commitment. There's a children's game. There's a kids game called the Dragon Klingon game. You can do the worksheet, actually two different versions of the worksheet live on the app. The app is set up to be totally and completely private. There's only one permission required in order for the app to operate on your phone, and that is the simple permission for the app to be able to use the internet signal or your online signal. Otherwise, there are no permissions required. We have no interest in dialing your phone or operating your camera or sending texts or the things that most apps are, you know, crazy permissions are asking for. And we did that purposely because it's a sensitive topic. When people start getting into the kind of issues that people carry around, it can be pretty sensitive. So we purposely made it extremely private. There is a second permission that is required if once you complete a worksheet, you decide to save it, because of course it needs permission to write it somewhere to your drive. So, but otherwise there are no permissions required. It was purposely designed to be totally and completely private. Go ahead, sweetie.
When you said it, including the commitment, it made me think Michael has edited the commitment again. But
oh, yes.
We have had Aria for 10 and a half hours both yesterday and today, so I have not had time to get it on the website yet, but it will be on the website before the week's out.
That's right. I actually meant to bring that up. I'll talk about that tomorrow, but I made another change on the commitment as a result of some teaching work I was doing. It's like, oh, there's a piece that's missing. So we'll share that with you tomorrow. In the meantime, everybody, create the best year yet of your eternal lives. An awesome gift to give the world, and blessings. Bye-bye.